Coast Voices, a program sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities in collaboration with KCBX and made possible through the underwriting by Joan Gellert Sargent. I'm your host, Chris Kington Barker. The CDC reports one in every 68 children in the U.S. has been identified with an autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, an increase from one in 150 that were identified in 2002. While ASD can vary significantly in character and severity, it occurs across all ethnic and socioeconomic groups and can affect every age group. Males are four times more likely to be diagnosed with ASD than females. We're all impacted by autism in some way. High-functioning autism is often missed and misdiagnosed, so many of us may work and live alongside individuals on the autism spectrum without even knowing it. More severe autism can also be missed. The topic of today's Central Coast Voices is the changing landscape of autism, and my guests today are Dr. Deborah Belke, a certified pediatric neurologist in San Luis Obispo County, for the last 18 years and one of the founders of the Central Coast Autism Spectrum Center. And also with me is Lori Ferguson, PsyD, and a licensed clinical psychologist. Today's show is live, and you can be part of our discussion by calling in with your questions or comments. And please, to make sure that you get on the air, I suggest you call in early. And if you want to take down the number, it is 781-3875. Again, to call in, it's 781-3875. And doctors, it is excellent to have you with me here today.
Thank you for having us.
This is really a huge topic. I mean, because we're talking about something that the incidence is very wide. And just reading the material for today's show, though, it was both astounding and eye-opening. So I'm sure you guys are going to be illuminating, too. What I'd like to start with is you obviously are both committed to this. And I think for personal reasons also, can you kind of talk a little bit about that going in?
Sure. I have a family member who's on the spectrum. And what I've seen is that there are both amazing benefits and gifts that come along with an autism spectrum disorder, but also many challenges. And so what I am really focused on is helping people to access services early on rather than waiting. And the take-home message from this is that it is never too late to start. You know, even if you're an adult looking at a diagnosis for the first time, there are still ways to increase your adaptive functioning, increase your quality of life. So at any age, it's a good idea to check it out if you have questions.
And how long have you been aware that you've had a child that's on the spectrum?
I actually don't have a child on the spectrum. It's an older family member.
It's an older family member.
Yeah, okay. So since very young age.
Okay.
So it's something that I didn't know at the time, of course, because growing up in that time, in that era, it wasn't something that was readily understood or diagnosed. But the more that I worked in the field as a psychologist, I started to put two and two together, and it became evident at that point. So I think that parents are always the first ones, or caregivers are always the first ones, to really sense that there's something different or particularly challenging for their family member. And if there's the sense that they have not received the answers yet to all of their questions, and it doesn't seem to fully explain what's going on, I really encourage people to get that assessment, talk with professionals until those questions are answered.
Okay, and Dr. Belke.
Yes, thank you. I am a parent of two children with autism, and also I have an uncle who is elderly with autism as well, who I've been care provider for. And I think that was one of the main reasons, just knowing the difficulties that can come along with that diagnosis, that was one of the reasons that we decided to start the Central Coast Autism Spectrum Center.
And as a pediatric neurologist, now, were you already a pediatric neurologist when you had your children?
No, I was not.
Okay. So it's a field that you pursued.
Well, I guess I'll take that back. I was in training at the time, but okay. I did not go into pediatric I didn't go into pediatric neurology because of that. I have family members who have some other neurologic issues, multiple sclerosis, things like that, epilepsy. So that was really my interest initially. And we're all a little quirky in the family. So I was expecting some quirkiness. And it's interesting. Now, in this day and age, a lot of those individuals who have autistic tendencies would be called quirky before. If they are magnified in intensity, depending on how magnified, starts to turn evolve into, now it looks more like autism spectrum disorder territory that we're dealing with. So I was kind of expecting, but not to the degree that we've experienced.
So let's talk a little bit about, if someone's listening and is not familiar with the autism spectrum. Now it's called autism spectrum, and before maybe it didn't have a name, or it was named by a lot of things you just mentioned: quirky, unusual, eccentric. What are the symptoms? I mean, how does someone know that they should be alert to this is behavior that may want to trigger a deeper look?
I think some of the easy to recognize issues parents realize. So parents typically know that the behavior is not typical, that they're having difficulties. Autism, really, I like to define it as a difficulty with social and communication in those areas. So social issues, communication issues. And a lot of times there are associated problems. There can be sensory issues, a child who can't eat in the cafeteria, it's too loud. They may be having meltdowns over things like that. They may be sensitive to clothing, to tags. So there's a lot of associated kind of bits and pieces that are red flags for autism. Often typical developing kids can have those issues as well. But when you have a lot of those issues, school difficulties, peer issues, issues at home, troubles with siblings, at that point it's no longer quirky. Okay, now it's really interfering with your life. And so we tend to call things a, quote, disorder when they really are causing enough impact. And I like to tell families, well, it's kind of like, are you sad or do you have major depression? At what point does it fall into a category where now it's a problem, we should do something about it? A lot of times in kids, we can see that very early. So some of the earliest signs can be an 18-month-old not pointing, for example. Instead, taking the parent's hand and putting it on the object, not realizing that they can communicate with that parent and get them to realize they want that toy. So kind of theory of mind, or understanding that somebody else has thoughts as well. And so those are the really early signs. So pointing, eye contact.
Not pointing
by 18 months. Mm-hmm. Not responding to their name being called. Those are some of the earliest findings, which don't look terribly exciting to a parent.
Right.
But your pediatrician should be doing screening 18 months. And they, I believe they're really good in this county at this point. CDC guidelines have come down. People are doing that type of screening, trying to pick kids up very early. But usually parents are honestly the first ones to recognize that something's a little bit different.
What kinds of things would a parent notice? I mean, the things like not verbally communicating,
mm-hmm.
Maybe a difference between the way a child is communicating than other children around them in their own age group.
Absolutely. And two of the most common issues that kids come into my office with, or that they're referred for, would be questions of ADHD or questions of oppositional behavior. So,
can you explain what that means?
Yes. So ADHD is attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. It used to be called either ADD or ADHD. Semantics
right.
change, and now we have ADHD. And there's inattentive types, there's hyperactive types, or combined type. And so kids will be referred primarily because they're having difficulty in school, either paying attention, they're jumping out of their seat, they're blurting out, and they may be having trouble learning because of those things, or in addition to a difficulty with ADHD, they have learning issues. So sometimes those same kids, or kids who just have difficulty following the rules, are referred because the question is, does that child have a severe difficulty with oppositionality? And I have yet to meet the child who is just purely naughty, you know, that
and
just
doesn't
exist.
When you're talking about an oppositional disorder, it's just, is that just a child that is going to oppose everything that they're
so
instructed to do? It's that chronic no syndrome?
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. So the impression can be that the child is engaging in a struggle of wills purely for the opportunity to win that struggle. Mm-hmm. But I've yet to meet the child who is purely oppositional, purely having a behavior issue without something else going on. So it could be autism. It could be learning. It is often learning, and we do often see issues with learning to some degree with individuals who are on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. I think the most common finding is processing speed. So we see individuals who just take a little bit longer to do things, to process information, to get started, to be self-motivated, to monitor their own behavior and then change their behavior based on their assessment of how they did. So all of that can take a lot longer and require a lot more prompts from the adults in their lives, and it gets very, very frustrating. So a very common issue that parents report is that, well, my child knows how to do X, Y, or Z. He knows how to put his shoes on, or he knows how to do his homework, but he just won't do it. And mm-hmm. then we prompt and prompt and prompt some more, and then that finally happens. And sometimes the work is great, and other times it's not so much. And so it can be very confusing for everyone in that child's environment, because there can be stellar work done at school, and then other times they're getting D's and F's. It can be very frustrating for everyone, but especially for the child, because they know that they can do better too.
Is there confusion between some of the diagnoses like ADHD and
absolutely
the autism spectrum?
Absolutely. And it is really hard to sort that out. And so one of the main challenges is that we all, including myself, I'm a parent of three. So, you know, we all have the belief and assumption that the professionals in our child's lives will identify what might be going on, accurately identify it, and recommend the appropriate supports so that things are solved. But what really happens is that budgetary limitations affect what's available in the schools. Time constraints from managed care limit the amount of time a pediatrician has to spend. We as parents are overwhelmed with lots of things to do, so we may not have the time to devote to identification and figuring things out. So it becomes very challenging to carve out that time and the resources in order to really figure out what's going on.
Do we rely too heavily, do you think, on the fact that the professionals will pick up
the
problems for the children?
Absolutely.
You know, do you hear from parents, you know, I thought there was something going on, but I figured the school would pick it up and let me know, or I thought the pediatrician would pick it up and let me know?
It's gotten so much better than it used to.
Definitely.
Just tremendously better. I used to see in my practice autism showing up for the first time at age 4 or 5, and that hadn't been picked up. Now that is just unheard of. So it's the awareness, the CDC, the American Academy of Pediatrics, they have really pushed early diagnosis, and I think it's made a huge difference. I used to hear all the time, day after day, I told my pediatrician, they told me I was a nervous mother, I paid too much attention. I remember with my son, I was told in the same day, you play too much with him. And then another provider said, you don't play enough with him. And it was kind of humorous. But that there was more of a, and it's always been, you know, down from the refrigerator mother theory of, well, it's just the coldness of the parent. That's why your child is autistic.
The refrigerator mother.
And that was a that was the accepted medical standard. That, yes. And we were still getting bits and pieces of that all the way up to, I would say 10, 15 years ago, the tide started to turn. It's just gotten so much better because people are aware now of what autism looks like. So I remember comparing my son to one of the neighbors. Well, my son's having about 10 meltdowns a day. They're lasting about 20 minutes. You know, new parent, and toddlers have meltdowns. Granted, I'm a physician, but, you know, I never timed meltdowns in my office, you know.
Right.
And, well, the neighbor, well, her kid's having them, but they're only a minute. Oh, okay. So it doesn't really raise, you know, too many flags. Parent knows this is odd. My kid is not acting like the other kids. And so in those days, oh, well, you know, kids will be kids, boys will be boys. Maybe you're not doing enough as a parent. And then And so I think that understanding has really come around. Yeah, as far as Lori's saying, no, kids are usually not naughty. They're not just naughty.
There's something else going
on. Something else is going
on. Are there different symptoms or different visual expressions between boys and girls, or do you see the same thing? Is there something that you're more commonly going to see in a male child than a female?
You can see very similar presentations in boys and girls or men and women, but what can be often confusing for everyone is that the girls can be more often more social.
Yes.
So they can be missed. Just like girls tend to have the inattentive type of ADHD compared to boys who are more likely to have the hyperactive type. Mm-hmm. So if you just think about which is more disruptive in a classroom, it's the hyperactive type of ADHD.
Right.
That will get identified earlier. So it's the same with autism. A child who has much more severe social deficits is going to be identified as something is going on with that child way earlier than a child who shows more social motivation. And one big misconception is that, well, you can't have autism if you really want to have friends, or if you're funny, or if you are really good at communicating. You know, all of these things can be true, but if you delve deeper, there can be qualitative deficits there that can be identified.
In adults who are diagnosed with autism later in life, is that kind of an eye-opening experience, or teens that haven't been diagnosed? Is that a helpful experience for them?
Definitely. And I think it explains a lot for them about why they may have had difficulties, because kids, no matter what is going on with them, whether it's autism or a learning issue or depression or anxiety, they tend to internalize that as their fault. So we don't see things like heart disease and diabetes as the fault of the patient unless they're engaging in really unhealthy behaviors that continue that disease process. But we don't see that issues that are related to mental or behavioral health or developmental disorders, we see those as often the manifestations of those issues, the behaviors, are the child or the adult's fault. So many people grow up with the thought that, well, I just must be lazy. I just don't try hard enough. I really must be naughty or oppositional, like everyone is leading me to believe, when that's the furthest from the truth.
I would think it's got to be both frustrating and exhausting and frightening for a parent. There's got to be, before a diagnosis, of having a sense that something may be going on with your child, you want to know, but you may not want to know. I don't know.
Definitely. I think that there are always individuals who worry, rightly so, that if they bring their family member, their child, for assessment, that the assessment will be wrong.
Yeah.
Because we don't have a blood test right now commercially available for pediatricians to just take
to
a blood sample and say yes or no, that's present.
Right.
So there is error. There is human error.
Well, and families will often come to me, well, I'm very afraid to get a diagnosis because we don't want a label. And I tease them. I say, oh, my gosh, if you could hear all the rest of the parents who come who say, my child has autism, they've just erased the diagnosis. They say he's fine and he doesn't need services anymore. And they're battling to get services.
Yeah.
So don't be afraid of a label. And I tell people, I could give all of us 10 labels right now. We all have at least 10 diseases. You know, there's all these neat categorizations of things, and no question about it. You know, allergic rhinitis, asthma, reactive airway disease, we all have all of this kind of stuff. And this is just a way that we use to describe, and I'll tell the family member, who often a family member will have a touch of autism as well, and I'll tell them, look, when you went to school and it was difficult, nobody gave you a label of anything. You just slugged through it. Parts of it were miserable. Parts of it were awful. Your family might have been mad at you half the time. The teachers really yelling at you. Whatever the issues were, don't you want your child to have a much easier time than that?
Mm-hmm.
If your kid had a reading issue, you'd take them to the reading lady at 5. If you have traits of autism, you would go get some help for that. No different. Doesn't mean anything else. And so not to be afraid of that. When you're 30, no one's going to go thumb back all through your school records and go, oh, you had a reading disorder at 2.
Yeah.
Or at second grade. They're just not going to do that. And so that label will only stick as long as it really is useful to you. And the second it's not helpful to you anymore, it's gone. People, they don't, it costs money to have a disorder, a disorder in the public school system. It costs money in the public agency. So it's going to be erased as soon as anyone can possibly erase it. It's the opposite problem that you're going to have.
Having I want to mention too to listeners that we're having some problems with our phone lines. So they'll be available at about 1:30. If you're trying to call in and you're unable to get through, I'm sorry, and I'll let you know just as soon as the phone lines are up and available. You are listening to KCBX and to Central Coast Voices, and we are having a discussion about the changing landscape of autism. And bringing their expertise to the show are my guests, Dr. Deborah Balke, who is a board-certified pediatric neurologist and the co-founder of Central Coast Autism Spectrum Center, and Dr. Lori Ferguson, a licensed clinical psychologist. Our show is live, and when we get our phone lines fixed, we're open to do that. You can call in with your questions and comments. So if you have those, go ahead and write those down, and I'll let you know just as soon as our lines are up and working again. So we've talked a little bit about the spectrum and some of the things for early signs. So talk a little bit about the center, and because that's really the meat and potatoes of what we want to get out today. And it's diagnosis and proper diagnosis clearly is very important. But then just to have a diagnosis is not enough. There's so much that can be done.
Right.
And let's talk a little bit about that.
Sure. Well, at the Central Coast Autism Spectrum Center, we are a 501c3 nonprofit. And if you want to get on our site, it's www.autismspectrumcenter.com. And what we have decided to do through the Autism Center is to try to fill in all the little gaps of things that at the time were not available. And we didn't want to duplicate services, but we wanted to just pull in the things that we knew were kind of missing. And our main event is the Walk for Autism every April. We use that as funding for our camp expedition, which is coming up this summer very shortly, in a couple weeks. And so our kids often can't attend a typical camp.
Why is that?
You get phone calls home. They're just meltdowns, peer issues. They're eloping from camp. They're off.
Withdrawn.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. But more just they're not safe. Yeah. And so for safety issues, you know, people are isolated. Families are very isolated. I had one woman, Hispanic woman. I always tell this story because it's just heartbreaking. In Paso, non-English speaking, with her four-year-old at the park. And so she was at the swing. He's on the swing. He's happy, has autism. She's with him. It's time to leave the park. Well, she takes him out of the swing, and in the full-blown autistic tantrum, he's going crazy. Because his behavior's not typical, the passerbys were very concerned that maybe she was trying to kidnap him. And so the police were called.
Oh, my goodness.
Police were called to the park, and she doesn't speak English, trying to convince them that, no, this really is my child. Well, why is he afraid of you? Why mm-hmm. is he acting this mm-hmm. way? Why is... So that mom's terrified to go into public. And so that's just an extreme example of how difficult it can be to just do the normal stuff we take for granted.
You know, and as you're telling that story, I'm thinking, how many times do we in a public place experience a parent with a child who's having just a horrible meltdown and immediately go to a place of lousy parenting?
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. or, gee, you know, that person can't control that kid without giving consideration to the fact that there may be something a lot more going on.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, and that's why we created, so camp, you're not going to get a phone call. Hopefully, you're not going to get a phone call. Well, we based the model off a camp that was held in Kansas that doesn't exist anymore. And the motto was, do not call the parent to pick this child up. You know, we can deal with this. And we have excellent staffing, excellent camp director. And we've got one-on-one coverage of those kids so that, you know, if there's a problem, we've got people that know how to deal with autism that can help out, you know, smooth over the rough edges so that they can enjoy a camp experience.
So the whole point of this camp is a camp that the kids can't fail at being at. So
exactly. Well, and they can be kids.
And the parents can be parents who've sent their kids successfully to a camp.
Exactly. And that was just the basics of camp.
Yeah.
So then it's okay, we have kids there. What can we do? What can we do that's fun? How can we build on social skills? How can we get kids to tolerate things that they may not have tolerated before? So we've got cornstarch and water and all sorts of crafts and games and activities.
Why cornstarch and water?
It's just a squishy, icky feeling.
Oh, and maybe intolerable.
Exactly. Yeah. And so sensory. And so to get them, you know, okay, now my hands are dirty. They've got cornstarch and water stuck all over them. And to be able to have fun. And so at a typical camp, okay, go wash your hands, you're done. Versus, oh my God, I've got cornstarch all over my hands. And this is going to be a big deal.
And a meltdown.
We got to deal with this. Going to take staff to deal with this issue. So it takes all, it's very staff intensive. Because of those issues, you don't know what types of things. And at a typical camp, things run smoothly, but, you know, pretty quickly. We've got good transition times, and you know what's coming. And it's just set up for kids with autism. So you can do the camp things, but it's pleasant rather than stressful. And, oh, my gosh, where do I go? And what group am I supposed to be in? And I don't want to do this anymore. I need a break, but I can't take a break because they told me I had to be here. And just all of those issues, mm-hmm. It allows for slower processing time. It allows for individuality. But we've got the staff there to make that possible.
I want to let you know that the phone lines are up and running again. If you have questions or comments about today's show, we're talking with Dr. Deborah Belke, a board-certified pediatric neurologist and co-founder of the Central Coast Autism Spectrum Center, and Dr. Lori Ferguson, licensed clinical psychologist. And we are now actually live and available on the air, and you can call at 781-3875 and join us. So again, that's 781-3875 if you've tried to call and couldn't get through. So talk a little bit more about the camp. You've got really close supervision of the participants in the camp age ranges.
Camp age range anywhere from it's varied each year. We've been down to 5 years of age, up to 18 years of age, but pretty much grade school, middle school kids. We've had some high school kids. We've had all functional levels. People are afraid of, oh gosh, you know, if there's children that are high functioning or low functioning, depending on where you're coming from, will my child fit into that model? It's worked out beautifully in that if your child is doing really good in life, you know, they're older and things are looking really good, they don't have to go as I'm a camper at a camp with autism. They can go as a counselor. They're helping out. Mm-hmm. And when we got a group of adults with autism together, we were trying to figure out, now, what do you want to, you know, what can we do? They didn't want to have a special event for them. It was interesting. Adults with autism, well, can we do community service for other people? So it's the same desires everybody else has. Mm-hmm. We don't want to be the special ones. We want to take, you know, from life the same joys everyone else does. And a lot of that is from helping others. So so how we interview every family to figure out exactly how could this be a positive experience for your child. And we start with that and then figure out, now, how can we make that happen and what kind of goals do we want to work on as well.
How many do you take in a camp?
We have served 60 children each year, plus or minus. The camp is 2 weeks. We are full this summer, but as soon as it's over this year, we start planning for next year. And
do they stay overnight?
They do not stay overnight.
Okay, so it's a day camp.
Yes, mm-hmm. In San Luis Obispo County. We do have other programs. We run teen dances, same idea.
Talk a little bit about the teen dance, because I think this is a really interesting concept, too.
Teen dances, we modeled as a way to get teens, you know, you don't want to go to the special ed autism dance. So it was...
I don't know why.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Who would, you know? So it's... We started as they're it's not a dance that you'd be nervous at. We're having dance planning meetings. We need people to help create a dance. Oh, well, okay, I could do that. I wouldn't have to go to the dance. So we have planning meetings before the dance. Those are facilitated by a psychologist, and who is outstanding, and to help the participants interact, some ice-breaking games, and then what kind of music, what would we like to do for art? But really, those planning meetings are social skill-building events. Mm-hmm. By the time the teen has done a few of those, and again, we've had all functional levels, low functioning, high functioning, in between. We make those work. We have Cal Poly volunteers at the meetings and the dance. Then it's, well, boy, I've done the meeting. Oh, I want to see how this dance turns out. So we have, you know, huge attendance at the dances, again, with Cal Poly volunteers. So when you walk in, it's a typical dance. Looks like a dance, but boy, here's somebody wanting me to dance with them. They're pulling me right in. And if I don't want to dance, we have a chill-out room that's nice and quiet, and so you can get away. So those have just been highly attended. We do family events. We've run support groups, outreach training. We've done speaker series. We've done our destination-supported employment program.
Talk a little bit more about that.
That's a program that we started in conjunction with Scientific Drilling, and
which is a company, right?
Company in Paso. They were called Applied Technologies, now Scientific Drilling. And they actually approached us, very innovative company, very forward-thinking. James Roche, Scientific Drilling, approached us looking for workers on the spectrum because he had heard through the grapevine, which is now becoming much more publicly known, that, boy, you know, adults with high-functioning autism turn out to be pretty darn good workers. They show up on time. They don't chit-chat with their neighbors. They don't have social issues. They don't usually end up showing up drunk or not show up at all. They're punctual, attention to detail. So if you screen...
They're not going to be surfing on Facebook.
Probably not. So stereotypically, there's a group of individuals with high-functioning autism that make very good workers. So We developed a program. We raised funding, which is how we fund all our programs, is just got to get the funding
donations,
from somewhere, donations.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Developed a program, and we were able to screen 21 adults with autism. 9 of them were placed with a job coach on site. 7 of them were permanently hired in competitive wage standard jobs at Scientific Drilling after the Scientific Drilling had the option to keep them or not, and 7 of those were kept. And so that's 7 tremendous success stories for San Luis Obispo County.
And what kind of jobs were they
all over the
in?
Board. So I don't know the technical specifics.
Sure.
But folks of all, my understanding was they're doing technical things, welding, some were measuring wires. I don't know much about well drilling and the drill bits and things that they build. But it was all sorts of different jobs. So I believe it was from low skilled to high skilled and anything in between. So our pilot program ended. The problem we had with we wanted to continue and expand to more businesses. The problem right then we had was we couldn't find any more adults with autism. So if 1 out of 60 people have autism, well,
where
are they in San Luis County?
Yeah.
I knew of a bunch. Well, yeah, but we didn't want to tell him he had autism. He lives at home with us. He's 35 years old. But, oh, we hate to label him. Uh-huh. But he's unemployed. Or there was a lot of those stories going on. So I think we're talking that there's a tsunami wave of children with autism approaching. I think their outcomes will be tremendously better in that they're identified early. They don't have to sit home with mom and be unemployed when they're 40.
Right.
Programs are being developed as we speak to get these folks in the workplace to make some minor modifications for differences. These are a lot of fully employable individuals. Again, that's not all of autism spectrum. There's some individuals with severe physical or learning issues. And, you know, through the center, we are looking at programs for all functional levels. But the gap that hasn't been as much identified that's kind of the new thing that's coming up is the higher functioning adult population.
But your programs are for all ages.
All ages, adults, children. We've got, I don't recall the date, but for example, the Children's Museum in Paso.
Yes.
We have autism nights sometimes. Low, we turn the lights low, keep it quiet. Families of kids with autism or an adult with autism, you can come to the Children's Museum if you're 30 and have autism and you want to do that. No one's going to stare at you. People are not going to be worried that you're there to kidnap their child. I mean, these are issues that come up.
You also don't need to have a diagnosis of autism in order to participate in any of the programs, services, or
right.
the center
That's
services.
That's an important point.
It's not like you have to, you know, whip out
Walk
your autism
your
card and say...
your autism here's my card.
So we kind of joke in the autism community, you don't have to have autism to come and play with us.
Actually, it does sound like kind of cool play.
It's a lot of fun.
You're listening to Central Coast Voices on KCBX Public Radio, 90.1 San Luis Obispo, 91.7 Salinas to Paso Robles, 95.1 Lompoc, 90.9 Santa Ynez, and 89.5 in Santa Barbara. The Central Coast Autism Spectrum Center provides support to individuals on the autism spectrum, their caregivers, and loved ones. Community outreach and education, like today's show, is just one of the many ways that they do that. And the guests that you hear speaking with me today on behalf of Central Coast Autism Spectrum Center are Dr. Debbie Balke, who's a board-certified pediatric neurologist here in San Luis Obispo County and one of the founders of the Central Coast Autism Spectrum Center, and Dr. Lori Ferguson, who is a licensed clinical psychologist. We have about a half hour left in today's program, and there's still time for you to join us in today's discussion with your questions or comments. You can do that by calling 781-3875. Again, that number is 781-3875. We talked a little bit about, you know, where are these adults that haven't been diagnosed as autistic? What would someone look for themselves and say, you know, I wonder if that's something that I should consider for me? Because there was a period of time about 15 years ago where that happened with ADD, right?
Mm-hmm, right.
Where that wasn't a diagnosis for those baby boomers. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden it was, whoa, maybe there's something more to my behavior than just being annoying to people.
Right. And I think for adults who question whether or not they might be on the spectrum, the most common things that people will come in and talk about as being challenging for themselves and for their families is a combination of things. Learning issues are definitely something that
what
is very common.
Learning issues?
Difficulty with completing homework and getting through projects, difficulty getting started and sticking with something, sometimes even projects that seem really exciting. It can be really challenging for some people to know how to prioritize and break down that task into manageable chunks and then stay on top of it. Mm-hmm. I work with several adults who are working on how to use a calendar and to make sure that they're staying punctual. And for things that are falling into a routine, like going to work, the individual is much more likely to be on time and to be very conscientious about that. But for things that kind of come here and there and don't fall into a predictable pattern, that can be very difficult. So often for individuals, it's getting into a fixed schedule, which sounds really rigid, but is actually very adaptive if mm-hmm. it's something that needs to happen. So it can be difficulty with activities of daily living, we say. So it doesn't always have to be so severe that the individual is never getting outside the house and never working, although that is a problem as well. For some people, it's hard to drive. Some people, money management and budgeting is very difficult. It's really hard to wrap their brain around how does that work? How do you predict? Prediction is very difficult. So how do you predict the amount of money you're going to need 6 months down the road? Mm-hmm. Other issues might be motor skills, which is related to difficulty in driving. So motor skills can be challenging. You might have visual spatial deficits. Again, that affects driving. Reading a map can be very challenging. Mm. But primarily, the person will come in with an overarching sense that things are just hard. You know, that's what most people will say to me, is just things are too hard.
I work harder than other people seem to.
Yeah, and it's so hard that I just have to back out of things more than I want to. And then my friends and family are upset with me. Mm-hmm. So definitely there is an overarching sense that things are very difficult for individuals with autism. And that's whether you're a child or an adult. And often they see that their friends, family, coworkers, other people that they've gone to school with, that their progression and their skills continues to improve. They're achieving all kinds of things that many people just think of as normal. You know, mm-hmm. you have a job and you drive yourself there and you have a family and it's, you know, you have barbecues on the weekend. It's the American dream. It's great. But these individuals are finding, you know, like Dr. Balke said, I'm 40 and I'm living at home with my mom and I feel like I don't have friends and I really want to get a job and I just don't know how to get started.
Yeah. How about the social interaction with other people? Is that something that kind of shows up for adults too, or the lack of
Definitely.
Ability to socialize?
Definitely. And so people will say to me that they just have a hard time understanding why people do the things that they do. Mm-hmm. Either why are people upset with me all the time, or how come I'm not getting these conversations? How come I always feel like I'm on the periphery of these conversations and I try and say something to participate and people just ignore me? Mm-hmm. Why is that? Mm-hmm. So sometimes the difficulties that people come in with are really concrete and specific. I'm anxious about flying and I really want to take this trip, but I can't, and I sure can't drive to Hawaii. So what am I going to do?
Yeah.
You know, and other times it's more severe. You know, someone who has obsessive compulsive issues where they've now started hoarding and their house is almost unlivable. Mm-hmm. So sometimes the presenting issue is something that can be related to autism, but we find that it's not just that issue that someone is coming in with. It's actually something more. But in most cases, people are very relieved. They're like, oh, well, that explains this other stuff that I was having difficulty with. And I just came to deal with wanting to fly in an airplane. And mm-hmm. wow, there's this other stuff, too, that I didn't think there'd be any solution for because I've dealt with it for so long.
Now, you had mentioned when you were talking about designing programs around the children or the young adults or teens, chill time and understanding that people process
Definitely.
At different speeds and allowing that adaptive time. Is that something that also continues for adults or the response to overstimulation?
Definitely.
To
and
adults
there's a whole
too.
Issue around that, because what families often don't understand is that, well, he has hours on his own. He mm-hmm. plays video games all the time.
Right.
Or he has avoided the last 5 social events that our family has participated in. He gets all kinds of alone time. Why would he need more?
Right.
But there's an issue, and I call it that everyone needs protected alone time. They need to know for certain that a given portion of their day is going to be uninterrupted. Because if we really think about it, when you go home tonight, think about the amount of times that we interact with one another.
Mm-hmm.
You know, hey, kids, time to do your chores.
Right,
or,
right.
honey, can you please help me with X, Y,
right.
or Z? It's amazing how many times our stream of attention is interrupted. And I found that many people are helped immensely if they can be left alone for a set amount of time when they know mm-hmm. for sure no one is going to bug them.
Mm-hmm.
Because then that time is true downtime, true protected downtime, I call it, where they can truly regenerate and control their environment 100%.
With the video games and the gaming world, is that an area where people on the spectrum can disappear into?
Absolutely, and there's pros and cons to that. So one of the cons is that families will say, well, I know he doesn't have an attention problem because he can focus on video games.
For days.
Yes. And they're really good at it,
mm-hmm.
right? So
right.
this might be the future programmer or the future game
right.
developer. So, you know, it's a laudable skill. But what we do know is that when we're talking about developing brains, children and teens, young adults still, that it can actually trigger the same reward pathways in the brain as addictive substances like heroin.
Mm-hmm.
So we know that, you know, video games and heroin obviously have very different outcomes, but the brain mechanism is the same, and the potential is there to become addicted to the fast-moving, very quick visual images, the quick rewards.
Right.
And so it becomes difficult to get off of those video games, even when that own individual knows, well, gee, I want to see my friends at swimming, but I can't stop playing these video games, and
mm-hmm.
and they can get very upset. So with kids or adults who have that difficulty, it's really good to limit that and make it contingent upon finishing homework or chores or other responsibilities. And then when the time comes for that video game time, give it to them 100% and don't bug them.
And don't interrupt it.
Don't right. interrupt it.
We're going to take a call here from Larry. Larry, are you still there?
Sure.
Hi. Did you have a question or comment?
I have a comment. I think it's all about learning, of course, and it's all about having tolerance for different brains, because all brains learn differently. And also, I think that we all should have developing brains, because when we stop developing, we're in trouble.
Very true.
I'm certainly closer to 90 than 85. And, they never had labeling when I went to school. And I'm sure I would have been labeled. Thank God they didn't have labeling.
Well, and at that time, they'd have put you in a special class, or you wouldn't have been able to go to school at all.
I never got into a special class, but I should have been put into
Maybe you're just special.
We're all special.
We are all special. That's exactly right. And I think what the doctors are talking about is making sure that individuals who have other kind of specialities receive learning and an environment around them that bring those things out.
That's correct. It seems to me that what you're doing creates that kind of environment. Mm-hmm. Keep it up.
Oh, thank you, Larry.
Thank you, Larry.
You were going to say something?
Yes, it's something that I talk about with parents a lot when they bring in their children or when an adult comes in and says that they've had difficulty in school. And it partly goes back to budgetary limitations. So we're definitely struggling in our schools with class sizes that are too big.
Yeah.
One overwhelmed teacher who, even on their best days, it's rough for them. They're underfunded. They're pulling into their own bank accounts in order to provide art supplies and even basics like pencils and notebooks. And, thank goodness for PTAs and other fundraising organizations in the county that help fill in those gaps. But the bottom line is we still have too many kids, too few instructors, mm-hmm. and not enough services. And part of that's related to federal laws that are not fully funded. IDEA is not fully funded. Congress asked and authorized for 40% of a special education student's program to be funded. And right now, estimates are that funding from the federal government is at about 15%. So the school districts need to dip into their own funds, sometimes the general fund, to come up with a difference.
Yeah.
And so that, of course, results in all kinds of difficulties. So when you have one teacher and 32 kids, you can only teach to so many different learning styles. And then when you're handed an IEP, a learning plan for a student that's 20 pages long, and you have 6 or 7 or 10 of these students in your class, of course everyone deserves to have a free and appropriate public education. By law, that's mandated, but we can't expect so much from one teacher and an underfunded school system.
Yeah. Yeah. You give through the center a lot of support and a lot of guidance and a lot of education to parents.
Yes.
When you are helping parents understand how to live with a child, a teen or a young adult on the spectrum, what are some of the more common things that you have to kind of get across? What are things that are more helpful for the parents to cohabitate and to cohabitate well with their children?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is for the parent to understand autism. So if your child had leukemia, you would know you're going to have to drive to Stanford or wherever you're going to have to go. It's not going to be your child's fault you have to go there. It's not going to be your child's fault they have to get chemotherapy. It's not going to be their fault that they're throwing up, that when they're miserable, when they have a fever, all of those things are going to require so much extra time. So autism, it's, try to get a parent to emotionally back up from it and see it for what it is. Mm. That behavior. What is that behavior? If you are an unemotional, just observer of what happened before that behavior, what's happening during the behavior, what happens after the behavior, what are the other kids doing, what's your husband doing, what's the, whoever's involved, to try to back up emotionally from it and unemotionally kind of assess it all. Now, what would make this better? And to know that 99% of it isn't, quote, the kid's fault.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean you still can't hit your sister, you still can't do this, you can't do that. There's still consequences for things, but why is this happening?
Mm-hmm.
And I love it when I get a family who's really intuitive, that, okay, we're here, we see the problem, what can I do? What can they do? What environmental changes? What can make this better? Rather than, oh my gosh, do you know what he did? He did that. It's terrible. And then he did this and she did that. And then all the kids were fighting. And okay, you know, let's back up a couple steps. How can we avoid it, prevent it? Is there a better way to deal with it? We do things called like social autopsies. Okay, after the fact, let's kind of dissect that. And you know, I had a parent tell me, you know, my kids are so anxious and they won't talk about it. I want them to talk about it. A lot of times they don't want to talk about it because it's so anxiety provoking. So how can we just learn new skills? How, you know, like the caller said, how can we be tolerant of differences? Mm-hmm. These are different people. They're not us.
Right.
So how do they process what works for them?
Right.
And a lot of kids, I don't want to go to a counselor. Go to the counselor because they've used everyone else as a guinea pig to figure out what works for them. So they have already tried. You wouldn't have to try all this stuff. They're going to give you, here's five tricks that somebody else in your situation has found that might work. Mm-hmm. So it's really just investigating and learning and trying to, again, back up from the emotional side of it to just if it's not working, let's not keep doing this.
Do you suggest with families that they engage the other children in this process too?
Yes, it's
is
tough. Is
that important?
It's tough if you talk to siblings. So, you know, part of it is you don't want it to be all about autism every day.
Yes.
But the flip side is, no, they're not getting treated the same. So
yeah.
How do you, like if you had a child with cancer, mm-hmm. Okay, your parents will feel bad and guilty. I had one that they felt so bad that their teen had to have a brother who had autism who was at the school and he found behaviors embarrassing and it was so difficult for him and she felt bad. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, if your other child had cancer, would you have that same bad feeling? No, we'd all just have to, you have to suck it up and deal with it, you know.
Right.
And so it's more of realizing this is just the way it is. It's an issue we have to deal with. Families have to deal with issues. There's nothing bad, wrong, shameful. We have to hide it. Don't tell the neighbors. It is what it is. And for people to understand, yes, we have to deal with the situation differently. And to pull in those siblings and understand. But that's hard for an adult to do. That's really difficult for a teen, a preteen, young child to do.
Absolutely. And I think that one thing that we find is that parents can really use a lot of support in setting certain boundaries. So making sure that they're protecting their own marriage, because the best gift you can give your kids is our happy parents. And not that you have to be gleeful every day. You know, having a kid with special needs is definitely challenging. But you don't have to take all the kids with you on every single vacation. You know, I worked with a family who was really devastated because they really wanted to give their child multiple vacations every year. And it was challenging because that child did not want to go and made everyone realize
miserable.
It made them miserable. So I said, well, it's laudable that you want to have your child experience all these different things in wonderful places, but what about you two? You both need to have time away, and the kids are older now. They can have a babysitter, and it'll be fine. And they found that they slowly shifted away from focusing all of their vacation time on the children and carved some time out for themselves, and that made a big difference.
In parenting, it has been consistently said that consistency is important. I'm assuming consistency is important here. Changing up the rules, flipping things around is difficult.
Absolutely. And resistance to change is actually one thing that we see a lot. It's one of the diagnostic criteria for autism.
Is more so with
yes,
the
absolutely.
Autism spectrum.
Yes. So you can see resistance to change, resistance to transitions, even to activities that the child or adult really enjoys. Shifting gears can be challenging. It's an executive function, which is often impaired in individuals on the spectrum. And it's, you know, let's face it, it's hard for everybody to change. So,
yeah.
You know, we all have to kind of tap into our inner Aspergian and our inner autism to really recognize that it's not just the kiddo with the challenges. We all have challenges and we can have a little more compassion. But yeah, resistance to change and transitions is very hard, and consistency will generally result when you try something new, a new plan, you're going to have an increase in the negative behavior before you're going to see it improve. And that's true of anything. It's true for ourselves. So if you employ some kind of new behavioral plan, you are going to see limit testing, kind of like the kiddo is saying, are you serious? Is this really the new plan?
I can make this go away.
I can make it go away. Right. And they get very creative.
Watch me.
Right.
They have all the time in the world.
And they're more persistent than you and I. So they're, you know, if you aren't ready to really go the distance, they will be able to make that happen so that the new plan just goes bye-bye. It can be very helpful to work with a behavioral therapist, and there are several wonderful behaviorists in the county who work specifically with kids on the spectrum and who do just amazing work. And it does take a considerable time and financial investment. We do now have insurance is required to cover autism as a parity diagnosis, and so that is something that has improved coverage for behavioral services.
Including on SenCal.
Including on SenCal, which is wonderful.
Okay. So before parents were having to dip into their own pockets or qualify for Medi-Cal or something.
Right. And depending on the behavioral program that's decided upon, it can be $40,000 to $60,000 a year. And again, that depends. If you need fewer hours a week, it's going to be much less, but it can reach upwards close to $100,000 a year. And so that's an example of when an autism diagnosis, that label, opens up a world to that child that may not have been available.
Of coverage, of paid, covered by your insurance, private, or like I said, SenCal Medi-Cal. It is covered on SenCal Medi-Cal now, which was huge.
And behaviorally responding is right now really the best treatment that's available. I mean, there isn't a medication that is given. There isn't a...
So right now, applied behavioral analysis is what most people are using. Some people have used pivotal response therapy and floor time. There's other things, but for the most part, most people use what's called ABA. And you're looking at, well, really, it's very simple. What came before the behavior? What is the child doing? And then what's happening after the behavior? How are we reacting to it? It's just really a common sense. You know, it sounds so fancy, ABA, applied behavioral analysis. It's really just a common sense approach to what just happened. And why did it, to step back and go, why did that happen? Why does that happen? What's the function of, are they doing this to avoid it, escape it? Are they tired? Are they hungry? What is this? And so analyzing that, changing up the environment, you know, getting kids where they can be more successful by making minor modifications that don't have to cost millions of dollars, that is the key to it. A classroom of a ton of kids, noisy, chaotic. I go in those classrooms. It's hard for me to sit there for an hour. And so really a lot of it's just environmental, you're understanding the behaviors, helping reinforce the behaviors you want to see. And then there, at this time, there is no known medication to treat autism. The core symptoms of autism do not respond to any medication we know at this point. There are two medications FDA approved for irritability and aggression that can be associated with autism. Those are very powerful medications. They work fabulous when you need them. So if you're having a meltdown in the car on the freeway and they're trying to jump out of the car, those medicines work for many people, and they are lifesavers. A lot do have side effects. So those two key that are FDA approved, real powerful. There are some others that are much safer that we try that can tone down symptoms a bit. So, but for the most part, for the autism itself, no medication. But for the anxiety, obsessive compulsive disorder, ADHD, for things we can see with it, irritability and aggression, there can be effective medications.
Okay. I want to thank my guest today, Dr. Deborah Balke, a board-certified neurologist, a pediatric neurologist in San Luis Obispo, Dr. Lori Ferguson, licensed clinical psychologist, and I want to thank you for listening today. You have been listening to Central Coast Voices, sponsored by Action for Healthy Communities. And I invite you to check out the website for the Central Coast Autism Spectrum Center, www.autismspectrumcenter.com. Thank you for listening to Voices.